This is Hiroshima, 45 years later. My name is Joan Pope. I'm with the Women of the ELCA as Director for Peace with Justice. And we'll be talking today about the following things. I thought I would give you a little outline of where I think I'm going, and you can tell me if we actually do go that way and if we get there. Due to the nature of our subject this morning, I think I'd like to start with prayer. Gracious God, help us to reflect today on the events of 1945 so that we may learn from them, change ourselves, and work toward a world of peace. In Christ's name, amen. I think it's very appropriate that August 6th and August 9th are, which is Nagasaki Day, are embraced by the rainbow celebration here at Holden, Rainbow on the Mountaintop, because there's some multicultural things to ponder about those 2 days. And the first might be, was there racism in the decision of whom to bomb? And since we weren't there, we may not know for sure, but it was not white Germany, but Asian Japan that was bombed. Secondly, as economics change and opportunities for students mean that the military is one way for poor students to get an education, the military is increasingly attracting persons of color. But those people in the administration and Congress are predominantly white, and those are the folks who are making decisions about sending persons to fight. But most of all, the solution, I think, is going to involve all countries and cultures. We're not going to be free of war until apartheid in South Africa is ended, but also the kinds of racism that we face in our own country have been worked on. And I come to peace work from a background of justice and anti-racism, and I can't work on one without thinking of the way it's connected to the other and the interconnectedness of peace and justice, not only today, but all the time. Let's start out by talking about the significance of the date and reminding ourselves of some statistics. The first atomic bomb fell on Hiroshima at 8:45 a.m. on August 6, 1945. It was a uranium bomb with the equivalent power of 12.5 kilotons TNT. And it exploded above a hospital near the heart of the city. Now, I heard a different figure this morning, but my source of information was this little book, said that 310,000 to 320,000 civilians were directly affected and 40,000 soldiers. By the end of December 1945, 140,000, including 20,000 soldiers, had died. And 90% of those died within the first 2 weeks. 92% of the 76,000 buildings in Hiroshima were destroyed by the blast of fire. Blast and fire. And Hiroshima is a flat area, so the effects were spread around the whole city. It was a little bit different in Nagasaki, where the bomb dropped at about 11:02 a.m. on August 9th. It was a bomb filled with plutonium with a power of 22 kilotons of TNT. And this book happened to give a description of the fireball in Nagasaki. It was a deep red fireball blazing like a small sun for 10 seconds. and it directly exposed 270 to 280,000 people. And there, 70,000 people died by the end of the year. It was a more powerful bomb, but it was dropped on a long, narrow area surrounded by hills, far from the busiest streets. So more were killed at Hiroshima than at Nagasaki. The survivors who suffered most were the babies, the children and aged, and the sick and handicapped. Many pregnant women suffered spontaneous miscarriages. There were many physical and mental defects, such as small heads, underdeveloped brains, cirrhosis of the liver, funnel chest, mongolism, leukemia, and cancer of the thyroid. And some of those things developed soon, and some developed years later. Have any of you had the opportunity to hear a Habakusha, a survivor of Hiroshima, speak? If you raise your hand. Do either of you want to make any comments about what you learned or felt on hearing that?
You spoke at ALC convention in Wisconsin. And she was talking about reconciliation and forgiveness. Which I thought was kind of interesting. It was very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
She was a very small person. Very powerful person.
Jody, do you want to say anything?
I was struck also by that theme. A couple of times I've run into and also, I think the other thing that struck me was the sort of way in which they were set apart from the rest of Japanese society in lots of ways, and have that kind of special identity within Japanese society. They sort of stand for something. It's been a real struggle for them. They're clearly people with a special significance in Japan's self-image at this point.
Plus or minus.
Really tough. I mean, it's. I think they felt for many years ignored, put upon a reminder of something that lots of people wanted to forget about. But also a positive, in lots of ways, a reminder that Japan itself doesn't want to remilitarize, or at least most of Japan doesn't want to.
You want
to
say anything, Bob?
We heard two survivors weekend of the peace ribbon 5 years ago today, yesterday, and the day before the ribbon time ceremony, there was a service at the National Cathedral of Washington, and a survivor, male survivor, and a female survivor were there, one from Hiroshima, one from Nagasaki, and they both spoke through interpreters. But the woman at the end of her short talk said in very clear English, "No more Hiroshima, no more Nagasaki." Which made it a very moving time.
Has anyone besides my husband and myself visited Peace Park in Hiroshima? Talked to somebody out by the bell yesterday, but apparently she didn't come. That too is a very moving experience, and I don't know if you've seen pictures, but the one dome it was a government building. This is that dome that now is in the center of that park, and the frame of it, of the building, is standing, and then this skeleton of the roof. But another part that is very moving about the Peace Park is the many photographs in the museum you can see, and things like all the artifacts, the bottles and things that melted, and And then also the signs of hope with the peace cranes from all over that are hanging all over, just many, many. One other thing I want to share with you, my husband and I were at the Peace Park in 1987, but in 1989 I attended a peace conference in Japan sponsored by the Japanese Council of Churches, and once the peace conference itself was unsettling to hear about the ways the U.S. was supporting increasing militarization in Japan because it seemed in our self-interest. But they can't, because of the restrictions put on their constitution at the end of the war, they can't really have an army, but it's more civil defense, or it has some innocuous name, but clearly the U.S. wants the Japanese as a military ally. And two other groups of people from the Council of Churches in Korea and Philippines were also present because they are very much impacted by whatever is done in that Pacific Basin. And I could talk about that, but what I really wanted to talk about here was when we finished our conference, we went by bus to Tokyo, and on the way we stopped at a small museum. And if I'd known I was doing this, I would have brought the book, because the small museum had only the paintings of two people, two survivors, a husband and wife of Hiroshima. And they were young adults at the time, were not married, had not met one another, I don't believe. And they were present in the city and then both left, and I think after several days or a week, the mail came back and helped with the cleanup, if you can call it that. I think it was much more than cleanup. And it was not until 10, 15 years later that they could begin to paint their feelings about Hiroshima. But they were paintings that were large. Maybe some of them would cover half, at least, of the back panel. And the images of humans, what I just see is the black and blood red large images. And they have toured with these paintings around the world, and when they were in the vicinity of Auschwitz and places like that, they were convinced by people who viewed them and talked to them of the similarities between the Holocaust and that, and so they have painted some panels that have to do with the Holocaust. And also one because it seemed like Japan was the victim, and someone from China spoke to them about a happening in 1937 of the Japanese massacring the Chinese. And my view of that, my memory of that one is just a lot of soldiers with swords kind of flashing around. But art has a way to move us in beyond words. So I think if we can keep some of those kind of images of photos and art in our head as we think today too. I next want to go with 1990. What's happened in 1990? Now I've got a list of some things, but I'd like to hear from you. What are some pretty significant things that happened in the world in 1990? That have to do with peace.
Berlin Wall.
Okay, the Berlin Wall. And all the accompanying things that have gone with the changes in Eastern Europe. We don't need to. How about the continent of Africa?
Independence of Namibia.
Freed Mandela. How about Central America? There was an election there that
The Nicaraguan
election, which turned out a lot differently than most people expected, but that was an important thing that happened in 1990. Two things I read in the paper the other night. It's been a while since I've seen one, but it said that the in December, the elections were going to be held in the United Germany, and also that the Pentagon was planning on cutting 50,000 troops by mid-1990s. Now, there may be also, someone talked about a war maybe starting, but we're not in the Middle East. And certainly that is the situation in the Middle East is something we need to be very alert to and facing with fear and trepidation. So that's kind of the scene that we're in.
We're also in the scene, though, of still having thousands of nuclear weapons that are still in place. And someone said recently that if they ever negotiate the Geneva Peace Accord, that we will have more nuclear weapons right now than when they began the Geneva process. So all we're doing is sort of modernizing, putting new ones into old ones, and yeah, making them more sophisticated.
We seem reluctant to change, though the world seems to be changing, we seem to be reluctant to cut down on the nuclear buildup. And that's another thing we need to remember, that there have been these changes, but we haven't seen the peace dividend yet as far as economically. As we look toward 95, which will be the 50th anniversary of Hiroshima, there are some other dates that we might think about. 1991 is an important date for the Philippines. Anybody know what that is? What's supposed to happen in 91? Pardon? Well, the agreements for all the bases in the Philippines. It's supposed to be that the country, the Philippines, can decide whether they want those leases to be continued. And economically, they're in terrible shape. And if the bases left, they would probably suffer economically. But they certainly are suffering with all kinds of things connected with that now. How about 1992? Anything about that date that you can think of that is significant?
Election.
Okay, election. Well, this is one of the farther. Pardon? The 500th anniversary of Columbus, and yeah, the. All the patriotism that may engender, but also here at Rainbow at the Mountaintop, how it might be viewed differently by particularly Native Americans and possibly those who are descendants of slaves, that perhaps it wasn't such a wonderful thing, this conquest of North America, Columbus, so that as anniversaries happen in your areas, perhaps you can be the voice of questioning. Maybe there might be some other ways to look at this, or maybe we should look at our history in a little different way. Another thing that is going to happen in 1992 is a ribbon around the earth. And did any of you, besides my husband and myself, take part in the ribbon celebration in 1985, where pieces of ribbon, 18 inches by 36, were constructed? They could be painted or sewn, or which showed something that you would not want to lose forever in a nuclear disaster. And there were 17 miles of ribbon in Washington, and 20,000 people. It was a very moving time, and the police said they'd never seen a better behaved group. There were a lot of women there who figured that you clean up after yourselves. And there was a lot of joy, a lot of hope. There are three different groups around the world, one in Geneva, one in New York, and one that Justine Merritt, who was the founder of the original ribbon, is doing from Grand Junction, Colorado, to have an international ribbon, a ribbon around the earth. And this time the idea is to, as you pray and work and construct a ribbon, to show something that you would not want to lose forever. So you can worry about nuclear disaster if you want to, or you can worry about whether just because of the terrible way we're treating the environment, you can lose it. So there is a continuing campaign, and I have up there the address if you want to learn more about the ribbon around the earth. This is a very low-key campaign. It's a woman with no income who just comes around and talks to people about it, and there's a little newsletter. But the hope is that the ribbon can circle the earth. It will have to be connected by rays of the sun and not people standing on the waters. But the idea is that people all over the world can do this. If you're looking at my outline, I'm now on peace education. How many of you are members of Lutheran Peace Fellowship? Anybody? Do any of you who are members have the current address? Or just the one? I have Lutheran Peace Fellowship in St. Paul, Minnesota. But
Tom told me, do you know more today? Tom told me when he was last here that they would continue to send the mail for some while.
Okay.
He didn't have it.
There's a new director, Tom Witt, and some of you may know Elmer from being up here, has been director since 1983, and he has resigned, and Bonnie Block, who lives in Madison, Wisconsin, will be the new director, and it will be relocated, but I'm sure that they'll forward the mail if you... And the summer issue on women in war is wonderful on looking at the implications of and the connections between women and war, and the sexism connected with war, and some of the things that happen to women in that war. I particularly think of that when we think of the Philippines and the prostitution and the things that happen to women around the bases there. But this is a wonderful issue, and it's a good group. I don't know if you have groups in your particular locations. I know in Seattle there's a group.
What was the name of it again?
Lutheran Peace Fellowship. And it's the second address up there. So if you want to learn more about what you can do, this is a wonderful way to do it. Also, in the ELCA, and are most people here members of the ELCA? Give me a chance to. Okay. There are two people who have the word peace in their job titles, and I am one of them, and the other person is Jean Martinson in the Commission for Church and Society. So she and I work together on many things, and you can get on the mailing list for peace petitions from the Commission for Church and Society, and that's at the Higgins Road address. If you don't have that, I've got my card here, and you can just cross out my name and put Jean's on it if you want to. But they... because of the budget crunch, if you want to get on this mailing list, it's helpful if you send a donation from $5 to $10. But and they cover such things as East-West relations, Central America, South Africa, each time.
There are free satchel copies of that in the Resource Center or in the literature rack in the foyer of the dining room.
Good. And one thing that Jean has put out is the ABCs of Peacemaking, which is books for children, suggested books which help children get a different anti-G.I. Joe and so on, Rambo view of the world. And this could be ordered from Jean or from... think you can order it from the distribution service, but it doesn't have, oh, it does have an order number on here, so if you want to order it, it's $3 from the ELCA distribution service. Also, a church and society is having a conference in October, October 12th to 14th, Perestroika, New Opportunities for Peace, Fair Trade, and Earth Care. It's going to be held in Des Moines, Iowa, and they were trying to get two people from every synod, but if you haven't heard about it so far and are would be interested in going, I think they still have some slots, so you could write Jean Martinson at ELCA headquarters and see if you can get in on that conference. And the women of the ELCA, how many of women here are members of the women of the ELCA? Every synodical women's organization is supposed to have a peace with justice coordinator. So she should have ideas for you to get involved in. Our dream is that that kind of thing will happen in every congregation, but we know it's a long time from thinking of it in Chicago and having it happen. But we have gotten to all the synodical women's organizations, so you might check with your SWO and see who the persons are. Now, you don't have to belong to the women of the ELCA. I'd like every one of you to get involved in something related to peace with justice. And so the Peace with Justice Week is in October. It has happened for 8 years. And the dates are October 16th through the 24th. October 16th is the World Food Day, and October 24th is UN Day. And you can do anything you want to. I mean, it's not saying that everybody should do such a thing, but that it's a time for ecumenically people getting together to do something to move forward the ideas of peace and justice. So if you haven't heard anything about it, please write there and you can get some information, you can get some organizing help, but check with Church Women United, check with other churches in your area, and plan something. You can do an interfaith worship service is a great idea, but you can also plan fairs and gather resources. You've got enough time. You can spend August doing it on your own, and then in September when everybody's back, you can join together and get something going.
But the resources that people can take into schools to give sessions with kids?
From the Peace with Justice Week office? Yeah. Basically what they have is an organizer's booklet and a poster for from 3 to 350. This is actually in the Methodist office, and this is an ecumenical bringing together, and of course none of the churches think they have any money anymore, so it's basically a grassroots, trying to support the grassroots people. They have a grassroots meeting each year to plan, which Lutherans are well represented. And actually, the last year, they said they had more inquiries from Lutheran congregations than any others. But we'd like that. And not only inquiries, we hope the people did something after they had made inquiry. One other date I'd like to call to your attention is November 11th. Remember November 11th as Veterans Day. But I know that Lutheran Peace Fellowship has been working very hard to make it a day of fasting rather than simply a Veterans Day, a day of fasting. So that might be something else you could do in your congregation or your community, is to have an alternative view of Veterans Day.
Is that a day of fasting in addition to Veterans Day?
Well,
or replacement?
I think it's a replacement, but You want to speak to that? You nodded right away.
Well, we did it here last year, and it is something that is done, has been done for a number of years.
A replacement.
It's just something, an alternative way of celebrating the day.
Alternative.
I always think of it as Armistice Day, actually. Old fashioned or something.
Now, I have, how many of you have ever heard of the Kairos document? Would one of you folks who raised your hand want to explain to the rest of the folks what it is or what significance it has? The Kairos document, K-A-I-R-O-S. Peter?
I'm not sure I'm going to highlight the part that you want, but it's a document written in 1985, I think, by South African theologians. And the thing that sticks out to me is its critique of state theology and church theology, any theology that supports continued oppression of people through coercion, supposedly based on scriptures.
Okay, anybody else want to add to that?
Well, there have been a second and third edition.
Yeah.
Out of Central America, and about a year and a half ago, a third one from seven third world countries together. The last one's called the Road to Damascus. continues the themes raised by the South African document, broadens them, I think, to include a definition of a crucial moment in all of those third world countries.
Yes.
And further to that, number one, there are copies of all three of those documents available in the Resource Center where you can go to read them. A group, a committee of people, including people like Norma Cathy Brown, Jim Wallace, Jack Nelson Palmeyer, several others are calling for reading and studying of those documents. There's a study guide available. I've got a copy of that and the address available in the Resource Center. They're asking congregations all over the country to study this and send them their contributions, their comments. The idea is that this will focus around the year 1992 in the hope of drawing up an American Kairos moment document. And they would welcome correspondence and people getting in touch with them. I can give you the address.
Just maybe to talk a minute about Kairos and Chronos. These are Greek words, and our chronological time and the clocks and so on are one kind of view of time, but the Kairos moment, the intervention into time, and that's South Africa, the South African document brought that out. And I had the Road to Damascus down there, so thank you for, but I think it's significant to just hear the countries, the signers on the Road to Damascus represented Christians from El Salvador, Guatemala, Korea, Namibia, Nicaragua, Philippines, and South Africa. So it's our fellow Christians in other locations are calling on us to hear what they have to say, and there is this attempt to get a response from those in the USA. So besides just writing for that address, keeping up with publications like The Other Side or Sojourners can help you kind of get in tune with those who are wanting Christians to do something in response, North American Christians to do something in response to those things. I have a couple other words on this piece of paper just as things that you might think about on this day as it relates to peacemaking. How many people have heard of low-intensity conflict? Will one of you give a little explanation to those who haven't heard of it? I don't have one here that I'm going to check you against. just so that we have a common knowledge.
I have kind way of saying we're going to have war and conflict, but we're not going to declare war and war everybody to pieces, but we're going to slowly grind everything down.
Okay.
It's well, Jack Buck Nelson Palmer was here a few weeks ago and spoke on this several times here at home. There's probably tapes available. Well, probably there are tapes available on the tape library. Look up Jack Nelson Palmer 1990, and you'll find the titles. And I guess it's just a way of declaring war on people without doing it openly, so that there's no public outcry, a way of pursuing our national self-interest militarily without appearing to do so.
Does the library have the book, Jack's book?
Yes, there's a copy of Jack Nelson Palmer's book in the library. There's also in the Resource Center several copies of the Lutheran Peace Fellowship summary paper off that
book. Yeah, that was good.
Which is a good way to get a quick overview in about 3 pages without having to read the whole book.
Yeah, that's good, I think, yeah. Jordy, did you want to say?
No, it's not. It's a very hot war. A lot of people are dying in it, but they're all people in Central America who they try to keep as invisible as possible and out of the media.
One way of thinking about it is all this debate that we have, I remember, in this country about what are the lessons of Vietnam.
Yeah.
Well, part of the lessons of Vietnam that the Pentagon understood was you don't send American boys to die on foreign soil, right? Mm-hmm. What you do is you build up a whole set of ways to squash a people, to squash a set of rebellions, using local folks to do it, right? With only with the American arms at arm's length.
Right.
Some of the things we saw
in
Nicaragua, the mining of the harbors, which is the most overt, but then the discovery of the CIA, how to assassinate a leader that we funded, but no one was ever supposed to learn about.
We don't really understand that or understood it.
Well, and one thing that hasn't been made completely clear is that this is not a term that Jack Nelson Palmer came up with. Mm-hmm. This is a U.S. government Defense Department term. And I don't have, I mean, there's several aspects to it, including psychological warfare and various things. But it's basically what Jody said, what the Defense Department learned about from Vietnam was that there has to be another way, and to do it in a way that the U.S. Populace will tolerate, maybe because they don't know about it, but also that it won't be American soldiers that die, it will be people in other countries, possibly persons of color. And so it's something that a lot of us probably wouldn't want our money going for if we fully realized what was happening.
What is the term again?
Low intensity conflict.
Okay.
You also can't put it on the news in the same way that you could in Vietnam. Stacks and stacks and stacks of coffins or bombing of villages by mistake, as we did so many times.
It's in keeping with the theories. I don't know if anybody's read Paul Ulrich's recent stuff in the Population Bomb Guide. He's got a book out that, among other things, explains how people are kind of, our mentality is event oriented, and you can keep it from being an event, and you can keep it spread so there isn't an event that the public can coalesce around. Then it can remain more or less invisible.
I think there are some people who are offended that some of us talk this way and think we're being unpatriotic or that we're one particular political bent, but politicians of both parties have supported this, and money has gone that way. So I, rather than take our word for it, I suggest you read what you can. But it is, there's war going on in many places that's evident in some places in the Middle East and so on, but particularly in the Philippines and Central America, our tax dollars are funding low-intensity conflict in ways that we probably don't want to.
And I asked you to clarify, you said we have politicians
would have supported this? Are they supporting low-intensity conflict, or are they supporting opposition to it?
They're supporting, if they are supporting the military budget, the Pentagon's budget, they are therefore supporting low-intensity conflict. So it's how they're voting on the military budget, basically. It's not saying, I am personally in favor of low-intensity conflict, but if our lawmakers are viewing the total budget, that is part of what's in there. That's what I was saying. Now, another term which is rather different but also important if you're interested in peacemaking is economic conversion. Now, are there some people who can explain that to the rest? Anybody? Probably the time that we knew the most about this was right after the Second World War, when the plants that had been putting out tanks and all those kinds of things became freed up to be used for the goods, the cars and refrigerators and stoves that people had been waiting for 5 years. And so industry turned from military uses to peacemaking, to domestic kind of. But this is very important because you people in the state of Washington know the importance of this, because if we shut down all the Boeing and so on, a lot of people would be out of work, and we shut down all the military bases. So it's not just simply saying, okay, there's been changes in Eastern Europe, we don't need so many things anymore. There needs to be some plans for not only the military people and the bases, but also the manufacturing plants that work at producing, whether it's aircraft carriers or planes or whatever. So this is another group of words that I always say we need to educate ourselves and then educate others and then be an advocate with the Congress people that we want a peacetime budget, we want things going for domestic uses, but we can't do it blindly and just put people out of work. Because one of the reasons that we have such a military monolith now is because it's economically been worthwhile for people. And so if we're going to change, we have to think about the economics of it. Peter?
The examples that you gave were consumer goods.
Mm-hmm.
And that strikes at another part of the problem that we have here. Are there some plans for economic conversion that don't deal so much with our consumer mentality, but move us in a different direction?
I can't tell you where I read this, but I think it was actually a proposal in Congress for the businesses and the community to work together to decide on their own how they would change. And I think that it would not necessarily have to be into some kind of consumer goods. It would have to be something that would pay off economically. But, the service industries, the health care, there's so many things, education, so many ways that we would like the monies that now go into military use to be put. But
our congressman is John Porter, and he's got Fort Sheridan, which is mm-hmm. the tag to disappear military bases in his district. He's having just the devil of a time trying to. He's taken that sort of attack,
mm-hmm.
public forum,
mm-hmm.
coalitions and so on. I just had a devil of a time trying to find something that would be economically productive for the area. And there's some great plans for parks and for senior citizens' homes and facilities, but those are, you know, compared to just a bankroll or a payroll or Fort Sheridan, or the idea of letting someone come in there and build something that those of us on the North Shore can buy because we have better paychecks. Nothing comes close so far.
I don't think it's going to be easy, but I think we need to collaborate and not just think that some office in Washington is going to come out with ideas, but that at each local area, I mean, it might be very different in the state of Washington what they can do than what we would do in Illinois. But if, and this was proposed legislation for kind of local control and with money enough to get the planning process started so that the community and business people and workers who would be affected would all together be talking about how, what can we do to replace this this military. You had a comment?
I think that it's important to remember, like in Jack Nelson's book on Hunger for Justice, about a third of the way through, he has shown statistically how many jobs you get if you take $1 billion and spend it on military or on NASA or on education, and it's about, you get about 4 or 5 times as many jobs in education or public works or any of that stuff. So a lot of this idea that military spending is good for us is false.
Yeah, that the jobs generated in the military are not as great as with the other. But it's going to require some pre-planning. They can't just close the doors and expect it's going to happen and expect people are going to be happy that, you know, I've lost my job. This is the only job I've had for 25 years. So we have to be really sensitive to, I know in the state of Washington, you have to be sensitive as a peacemaker to the folks who get their income from something that is right now military related, but that doesn't mean that we give up on the whole idea. Any other comments or questions? Jody?
Just a quick, I was, a friend of Scott's is in the village now, a guy named Leo Maxwell, is an executive with Motorola. And Motorola has been a fairly significant defense contractor over the last 30 years. And he says that just like that, after the Eastern European events, stuff began to change at Motorola. An entire division, the tactical division, was virtually shut down. That the signs are there, and that the big corporations are already doing it awfully quickly. So that this is, you're not talking about something that's sort of pie in the sky here. It is happening, whether we can shape it in a way that actually creates more jobs and deals with some of the stuff that we need to deal with in this country seems to be another question.
Yeah, and that doesn't become more consumerism,
that's right,
materialism.
You don't really need a better CD right now.
No.
The comment I would have is that it seems to me that what is happening, what has happened, what will continue to happen is that the federal government will do the things in the military budget which will put the greatest squeeze on the ordinary citizen, whether you close military bases or whatever you're going to do, create the greatest chaos among the people, but we will continue to fund multi-billion dollar kinds of programs. And those programs will continue to be Star Wars, and other things will continue to go on. And what you'll do is put out, you know, PFC John Jones, who was going to go to one part of the country or another, put him out on the street, make him unhappy, and make, you know, his family's unhappy, and his relatives unhappy, and make, you know, the rest of us unhappy because he doesn't have a job. So what we will do is do what we usually have done. Decisions will control, the government will control us, and continue to do what, you know, what we've done in the past. And that's a very pessimistic view, but I really, our own congressman in our area wrote me a 3-page letter saying that there was absolutely no sense, you could not save a nickel by cutting any of the Star Wars, MX, anything else. You know, and said you couldn't save any money by doing any, eliminating any of these programs. I mean, if you got that kind of arithmetic going for you, well, then, you know, I mean, where's that?
Okay, I want to do a commercial for a 8-page brochure on the federal budget. I think we all need to get much more comfortable with the terminology of the federal budget and get much more involved in the federal budget because they deal in the dollars that amounts that we can't understand. We're all being done in by the budget and the deficit and so on. And Sister Amata Miller with Network in Washington, D.C. has come up with this 8-page helping us understand the federal budget with the idea that once we understand it, then we can talk with knowledge to our legislators and so that we have more control. One of the comments in it is that in the 1980s, achievement was getting the people in the U.S. to think of themselves as taxpayers rather than citizens. So I thought was an interesting. We are more than taxpayers. We are, of course, taxpayers, but we are also citizens, and we need to get much more involved in the process. I mean, the voting records in the U.S. are terrible, but I think we all feel a loss of power because we don't understand it, and there's great effort made to make it more obscure. But this 8-page pamphlet on the federal budget makes it much more understandable, and I would think that after you read that, you could write back to your congressperson and get them on a few things. So I would encourage you to. I don't have the address, so if you would write me, I would get it to you. I'm going to get a boatload of copies. So you can write me at the ELCA office, and I have my cards, or if you know the address, just Joan Pope at Higgins Road is enough. Any other questions or comments? There has been one effort that I didn't mention here. Has anybody heard of JPIC? Jody, you're the only person, or Peter? Which one of you wants to enlighten the rest?
Justice, Peace, and Integrity of Creation is an effort by the World Council of Churches to focus Christians around the globe on the interconnections between justice and peace and integrity of creation. And there are a whole lot of activity around this, I understand, including a lot of materials being produced, a lot of ecumenical conversation going on, conferences being held and so forth. One of the foci that I'm aware of, at least in the United States, is tied into 1992, and urging United States Christians to reconsider 500 years of colonialism and its relationship to justice, peace, and creation.
Peter, do you want to add to that? Or? I think it's in the issue of this that you have extra copies of. It's Justice, Peace, and Creation. It's a part of Mission 90, and I'm sure some of you have heard of Mission 90. But when the ELCA formulated this, they didn't want to use Integrity of Creation, but it's based on this World Council of Churches thrust, Justice, Peace, and Creation. And the way that the Mission 90 is going with this is our children at risk and the terrible things that are happening to our children nowadays because with the changes in the budget, because the Grey Panthers and so on can lobby. The elderly are not as hit by poverty now as children and single families, mothers with children. So you can read more about that in this issue of peace petition since the spring 1990. But it is a very connected thing. And when Gene Martinson and I were in Germany in 1988, in Europe, they're much more into this than they are here in the U.S., but the groups would meet separate. I mean, they would meet on the same day in one church, and the creation group was here, and the peace group was here, and the justice group was here, very much letting people pursue their own interests, but helping them see it's all tied together. And I have the feeling here in the U.S. that we don't quite get it tied together so well. But I've been at international peace meetings where the idea has been suggested that within, you know, 15 years, these issues of justice and peace will be forgotten because we will be all clinging to one another because of what we've done to the environment and the earth, and that there will be no other issue than how to survive and survival itself. And maybe right now that doesn't seem like a peace issue, but it really is. Mm-hmm. Peter?
I want to respond to that. Since seminary, it's troubled me that neither the peace movement nor the environmental movement was really very highly populated by people of color. And one of my classmates, you know, my best friend, as a matter of fact, and I concluded that, in a sense, what you just said is true, and but it's going to take 15 years. But the problem is that both the peace movement and the environmental movement are concerned with not dying together rather than living together. That's sort of the concern is we, not so much we want to live side by side with people of color, we don't want to die together. And it sounds like, again, we're moving to a place where we ignore or are already sort of wanting to give up the justice end of it,
mm-hmm.
To jump ahead to make sure that I still have my gas guzzler, or at least my ability to drive around 20 years from now.
Anybody want to respond to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is why, especially this summer, and several people have been through here, I'm so excited about this Kairos moment document thing, because it seems to me that that is one way in which maybe these things will be synthesized and brought together, and we won't just get off in one little corner. Because ever since coming here, I've been overwhelmed with, there's this issue, there's that issue, there's this one, you know, how am I going to get all these into one picture? It seems to me that maybe this Kairos document, Discerning Our Kairos Moment in America, is maybe the vehicle for doing that. So I really encourage you to come get that address.
Is it the Sojourner's address? Or what?
Well, no, it's Jack Nelson Palmer's address. And you can write to him and get on the mailing list. He just asked that everybody send a self-addressed envelope to begin with, and he'll get you into the network of the thing and try to get your congregations involved. And I have all of the file of the articles also from Sojourners, from The Other Side, from several other magazines, Creation Magazine. A great many of the magazines, journals in the last 6 months have put out articles and critiques and reviews of this whole process, and those are also available.
Question?
I think there's an interesting commercial out now, and I don't know what it's for, but it says we don't want, Americans don't just want to survive, they want to succeed. Mm-hmm. And that gets at, and something I've noticed, and I don't watch much, but like Johnny Carson stuff, there seems to be a willingness for people to accept their tremendous wealth, the celebrity types, and to flaunted, which I didn't see 15 years ago. It's kind of like, hey, this is okay. Too bad for those people that don't know what's happening. I mean, I see that shift in commercials and television.
Well, of course, that's been fed by the tax laws and the ways that we now have created all the billionaires and so on. So.
And the way we report the news.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
we
all make fun of the National Enquirer, but what's on the front page of all the newspapers? What cares? Who cares who Donald Trump sleeps with?
Yeah, right.
The media, I mean, we could do whole sessions on the media, but that is another thing. I hope that you not only read the daily paper, but you have some alternative messages.
I think, too, that the church is, as it says it is interested with truth, that we cannot be caught up in a lot of fadisms, which I think the oppressed people throughout the world have always felt that what we are about is controlling the issues and going from one issue to another. And if we still believe that poverty and oppression are there, whether or not we live 15 years or 20 years more really isn't the issue for us, but addressing problems that we know that are right in front of us that are not going away, that there's truth there to be wrestled with. And I think that applies to the church, and it really disturbs me that the church is so often caught up in fadism, and that we are a reflection of our society, whether it's media or whether it's what's going on, and it's unfortunate that somehow we haven't been able to keep our head and continue to be giving some sort of semblance to those that are oppressed that we're really sticking in there through thick and thin.
Thank you. I guess we're approaching closing time. I'd like to just give a little pitch that we go out with zeal to work for peace and justice in our own hearts and in our communities and in the world. Thank you.
Thank you.